Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Jazz was a complete revolution in music. By the 1920s, it was a major musical presence. Everybody knew it. The conductor, Leopold Stokowski, knew it. Jazz, he said in 1924, has come to stay. It is an expression of the breathless, energetic, superactive time we live in. The distinguished conductor declared it was useless to fight against it, which is a funny way to put it. The New York Times insisted that same year, 1924, that jazz would seat the highbrow beside the lowbrow at concerts. Syncopation, the article continued, will doff its informal attire and don evening clothes, even to the high hat and the cape. Back then, Americans seemed to want to find some way, for whatever complex reasons, to combine the new jazz with what people were used to, concert halls, symphonies, and long-haired conductors. That year, 1924, was the year of Paul Whiteman's landmark concert at Aeolian Hall near Times Square, featuring the orchestration by composer Ferdy Groffay of Gershwin's jazzy Rhapsody in Blue. The concert is part of a contradictory legacy for Whiteman, who, despite having played no actual jazz on that night in 24, became widely known as the King of Jazz. Meanwhile, at Carnegie Hall in the 20s, American composer George Antheil premiered his jazz symphony from the piano keyboard, with the W.C. Handy Orchestra behind him. He quoted jazz in the piece, but also Stravinsky, ragtime, old-style waltzes, and popular tunes. A few years later, African-American composer William Grant Still wrote the Afro-American Symphony, using jazz and blues, and gave the different parts of the piece titles like Sorrow and Longing. I wanted to demonstrate, Still wrote about the piece, how the blues, so often considered a lowly expression, could be elevated to the highest musical level. Whether blues needed to be elevated is a matter of opinion, but even after that burst of activity in the 20s and early 30s, when jazz was new, the combination continued to fascinate. Why not let jazz be jazz and symphonies be symphonies? That's not what happened. Through the decades we go. Stravinsky, famously influenced by jazz decades before, went ahead and wrote something closer to an actual symphonic jazz piece in the 40s. The Ebony Concerto was written for the Woody Herman Band, and they played its first performance at Carnegie Hall in 1946. On the other side, Duke Ellington couldn't resist the symphonic sweep. In Night Creature, commissioned by the Symphony of the Air in 1955, this recording of it has Ellington conducting a kind of international pickup orchestra. It's more jazz than symphony. Gunther Schuller in the 60s even wrote a kind of jazz version of Peter and the Wolf, with words by Nat Hentoff, telling the story of a young trumpet player who tries to cross over from classical to jazz. Leonard Bernstein presented it on television.
Peter could not find a place for himself. Every time he tried, the music would simply sputter to a stop.
It was part of Schuller's very serious notion of a third stream, something that combined the two forms, but that was neither jazz nor classical. It did not last. Still, even people well-practiced in both forms found the pull irresistible. In the 70s, William Russo, a Chicago classical and jazz composer, put the forms together pretty convincingly in a piece called Street Music, which he subtitled A Blues Concerto. Russo said at the time he hoped musicians would be loose and even haphazard in the way they performed the piece. And on it goes. What's fascinating is this continuous craving since jazz appeared to do this with the music. With the patronizing notion, sometimes, at least in the early days, that the concert hall might raise jazz up from humble beginnings. Or with the sincere notion that these forms could actually talk to each other. White band leaders like Whiteman, black jazz musicians like Ornette Coleman, big shots like Gershwin and Ellington, they all must have believed, to some degree, that there was value in this union. And now Wynton Marsalis with his new swing symphony. In his 2010 version of Jazz Meets Symphony, a jazz band and a symphony orchestra play together. But the great divide is still there. Listen to what Marsalis and Sir Simon Rattle had to say when they played the world premiere of Swing Symphony with the Berlin Philharmonic a few months ago. Sir Simon Rattle on the classical side.
So many people in the orchestra have said, you know, the trouble is we just feel so stiff in comparison.
Wynton Marsalis on the jazz side.
And we're saying, we're looking around saying, every time somebody plays, we're looking saying, damn, did you hear that? When the bass section played, everybody in our band was like, phew. Oh, man, listen to the guy, the way he's playing. So it's a certain deep respect and collegiality that is genuine.
Funny, isn't it? Some version of that same conversation could have gone on in 1924, really, with all these composers of every stripe turning their heads to the problem of how to unite these forms. Maybe their separateness is what keeps them going. Or maybe Marsalis will crack it. Meanwhile, it's fun to listen to the last 90 years or so of people trying to make it work. So, here comes another. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fishkin.